Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
If we can agree on that nobody has all the solutions by themselves and we open up a city or an organisation, then we also need to give the resources.
I always feel this very big connection with the city, just like to be in front of a friend. I really think that this inspiration is coming from the city itself.
We're in the Italian city of Turin today, as last week it played host to a crowd of urbanists, designers and city enthusiasts for this year's edition of Utopian Hours. Their theme this year was the 1,000-minute city, a play on the subject of the 15-minute city, arguing that urban life goes way beyond our own doorsteps. Curious? Well, join me now as we turn over the show to the urbanist Carlotta Rebello, who reports this week from Turin. It's all coming up in the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, right now.
This week I'm coming to you from Turin, where this year's edition of Utopian Hours is just getting underway. This is an urbanism conference that gathers over 30 global speakers and a crowd of 1,000 urban aficionados over the course of 3 days. The venue playing host to us is La Centrale Lavazza, the recently refurbished old factory of the iconic coffee giant. The theme setting the tone for the event is 1,000-minute city and how to create more inclusive and sustainable spaces. It's nice to be back in Turin and see our friends at Torino Stratosferica, the conference's organizers. This is, after all, an event that we've covered over the years, and this time I was eager to find out more about the innovators championing change in their own cities and also discover a few new projects along the way. So, let's get started.
Welcome, benvenuti. Grazie a tutti di essere qua con noi.
My name is Soraya Axelsson and I work as the head of H22 in the city of Helsingborg. H22, it's a big investment from the city of Helsingborg in developing the future city, the smart, sustainable and the thoughtful city. So it's all about how we can use innovation to create new solutions for all the challenges that we have and that other cities around the world have.
Now, one of the things you mentioned when explaining just a couple of minutes ago the project here at Utopian Hours is how the city basically invites not only people from outside, but big corporate entities and private entities to rethink the city as a whole, and everyone gets involved in the process.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because I think we have a shift that is ongoing, that if we want to solve the future challenges that we have, we need to start to look at our cities as platforms and test beds, because a city organization will never have all the solutions. So we need to make it possible for others to test their solution, test their ideas, and also create innovations and projects that will give a higher quality of life to the people living in the city, but not from an internal city perspective, but from an external perspective. So that's why we are inviting everybody to use Helsingborg as their testbed.
And how is that translating into practice?
Well, it's translating into practice in the way that if a company, association, a citizens, or even the academia have an idea that they would like to test, they can take contact with us and then we will try to make it possible. So, for example, we are collaborating with big global companies that are trying out how they can be a part of the societal change that is ongoing. They can test technical solutions, but they can also invite citizens into their projects and so on. So, as a city, we're more of a facilitator and enabler than we are just a producer of service.
I'm curious to hear from your perspective what has been the residents' and citizens' reaction to the whole process, because basically everyone overnight became a mini urban planner almost.
Yeah, both a mini urban planner but also a potential innovator, because if we can agree on that nobody has all the solutions by themselves and we open up a city or an organization, then we also need to give the resources. So I believe that the residents of Helsingborg, they are empowered to be a part of developing the city, and we have actually created structures for that. So, for example, we have a vision fund. So every year we hand out 100,000 euros to residents that have ideas that they want to test and do. We don't micromanage. It's not a big process to get the money, but they can actually try to fulfill their dreams. And in the end, it will make Helsingborg a better place. Another example that we also have is something we call the Pixel the Pier. So it's a pier in the central part of Helsingborg where as a resident or a company or organization, you can have like 10 square meters and you can do whatever you want as long as the fire restrictions are in order. And then you can also get money to develop different projects or test beds. So I believe that the residents have taken it very well. They like to be involved. It's their city.
And they get to be part of what happens to it.
Yeah, and we have actually decided that the focus of developing Helsingborg is to improve the quality of life. And we use it both in big projects, but also in small projects. We have one project, it's a big area called Drottninghög, Queen's High in English. So it's a big public housing area where the residents for the past 10 years have been involved in refurbishing this area. So it have gone from quite worn down to being an integrated part of the city. And instead of just going home in the beginning and making a plan for the refurbishment with the monetary stakes on top, we started on knocking on doors with a bag of Swedish fika. That cinnamon buns and coffee and so on. And then we asked, what are your dreams? What would it take for you to actually be able to live here if we refurbished the area? What changes would you like? And the great part about this process is that all the residents are very, very proud to be a part of developing the area. And almost nobody have left.
Now, everything is kind of culminating into next year, next summer, where basically you're hosting a world expo but at a city level, which is very intriguing and I want to know more about it.
Yeah, so all this innovation work, we have been having this project ongoing for a couple of years. We want to showcase all the solutions, but we also want to build a platform so that we can continue the discussion and continue testing, continue doing it. So that's why we are arranging the H22 City Expo. It will be ongoing from 30th of May till 3rd of July next summer, 2022. And then we will use different parts of our city to showcase innovations, have different pavilions and exhibition areas, conferences, meetings, congresses. We will have study visits and we will have different experience. Probably the visitors will see something that they have never seen before. That's the goal. But what we are doing is that we're creating the place for the urban discussion next year. And we are inviting everybody to be a part of both showcasing solutions, but also to join the discussion.
It sounds from everything you're describing that the fact that the city is not a major capital has been to your benefit. The fact that all these projects can be implemented exactly because of the advantages of having the size of the city you have. And I think it is good to pay attention to the smaller players too.
Yeah, I usually actually say that we are a city that is small enough to be quick, but we're big enough to have muscles. And there's something very interesting in that part because we can move fast. We can collaborate in a way that maybe bigger cities will have difficulties in. In this H22 project, all our 9 different departments, all our 6 fully and partly owned companies are working together on a daily basis. All the 10,000 employees are a part of the H22 process. And I think in a bigger city, it would be much harder to involve everybody.
For the next interview, I'm here tag teaming with our own culture editor, Chiara Rimello, who's also here at Utopian Hours in Turin. And she has quite a fascinating interview coming up next. Chiara, who are we going to hear from?
Well, we've grabbed Marina Kiriakou, who is from Urban Gorillas. She works in Nicosia in Cyprus, and she wears many hats, really. She's an architect, urban planner, but she's also the cycle mayor for the city. She has a sustainability focus, also has a rather interesting project, kind of spanning the whole of Europe, but born in Cyprus, about making use of our rooftops. So we had plenty to talk about with her.
Well, don't give it all away at once. Let's have a listen.
Marina, thank you so much for giving us the time. Your presentation here at Torino Stratosferica touched on so many different themes, and we would like to unpack some of them. You come from Nicosia in Cyprus, and you've observed the life in Turin in the last few days. I would like to jump to the kind of cycling side of your persona, but how sometimes we just expect that if we draw a line on the ground and we call that a cycling path, then suddenly it's turned into a cycling path. What conditions need to exist to make public space genuinely accessible to cyclists, a cycling path that is an actual cycling path and not just a drawn up one? And how can we build and make our cities more cycling compatible, given you're the actual cycling mayor, so you'll have plenty to say about this?
I do cycle in a very car-dominated city, but it's also a small city. We do not have tram. So for me, what was complex here in Turin was to deal with the fact that there was a tramway and there was also a stamp of a bicycle on that. So I could use it, but I wasn't sure. That was a bit frustrating for me to understand how all these different modes of transport coexist. But in terms of the conditions, I think depending on the city and the different elements that compose the road network, it can be different solutions that can create the right conditions for cycling. Because in the road, you are in a system, so you interact with other users. And if those other users are not cyclists like you, there are different dynamics. So definitely the car has a very big role in making you feeling safe. So the way that we can control a little bit the car traffic can definitely have a huge impact in increasing the sense of safety for a cyclist. Then there's definitely the signage and how you visually communicate the fact that this is the way for you as a cyclist. And in general, how to handle the boundaries between pedestrians, because like here in Torino, I saw bicycle lanes that are to be shared with pedestrians. So that creates for me also some dynamics that are not safe for pedestrians. There are so many things that we can't say, but I think the solutions already exist. There are already good solutions that we can replicate for some leading cities that are cycling cities. And we can definitely start by reducing the impact of cars in the whole road network. And when you actually achieve that, then even people can adapt and slowly be more ready and more confident in the way that we use it. So you actually make the first step by reducing the car traffic, and then people will also start, you know, navigating the city in a correct way. And cycling has something very important. You use a lot of eye contact, so you communicate with people in order to see. So when you're in your car, you don't really see the other people's face. So I think this human scale of cycling, it should be the starting point for designing for cycling, and the same for pedestrians, of course.
We've talked about your role as bicycle mayor of Nicosia in Cyprus, but you wear lots of hats. I would just like to zoom into one specific project that you mentioned during the presentation, which I thought was very, very interesting from the point of view of how it can reveal a whole new perspective and layer to our cities, which is the rooftop project. Can you talk to us about how that network came to life? What is it, how it works, and how it can expand beyond Nicosia and through Europe?
So 2 years ago, we met different organizations and initiatives or groups of people who are working locally to reinvent their rooftop scape or the roofscape. So as Urban Gorillas, we came in contact with organizations in Portugal and in Rotterdam first. And we discussed, we learned what everyone is doing to promote the alternative use of rooftop in their city. And we decided to meet in Portugal, where we invited other groups who are actively doing our festivals or projects to create more multifunctional rooftops. Then from that little first network, we created a proposal for the Creative Europe program of the European Commission, and we got a very good funding for 4 years to really do research and projects and small pilots festivals and installations on rooftops. Every partner of this network is doing and implementing this project locally, but then we interact a lot and we learn from each other. And we start first as the European Creative Rooftop Network with these 9 cities participating in the project. But of course, our aim is to be international, because there are so many other initiatives on rooftops that we want to follow and we want to learn from. So what we are trying to do is to create a movement.
What kind of things happen on these rooftops? How can people access? You know, obviously rooftops are not such easy places to get to, because they always have this sense of privacy about them. If you don't own the building, if you don't live in the building, you can't get up top. And what happens there? How can people get to it?
What is important is to understand that there are different typologies of rooftops. When a rooftop is on a private building, it's of course more difficult to access and maybe can serve more for the community that lives in the building, or if it's an office building, it's for the workers. But when it's a public building, then it can actually be more accessible to people. And maybe on the roof there is a garden, or maybe it's a playground, or maybe performances are organized there. All kinds of events can happen there. And there are also all the sustainability projects that can happen. So maybe sometimes the objective is not to make the rooftop accessible, but to use the rooftop in order to fulfill other goals. So depending on the city and the urban fabric and the built environment, accessibility can be a huge or a smaller problem. But what is important is to engage with the right stakeholder to start giving access to more and more rooftops, not to invade that level of the city, because what is a good quality of the rooftop is the fact that it's actually quite private. So we do not want to ruin that by all going up on the roofs, but we just think that it's good to start playing around with that level and creating more exchange between what's happening in the city at the public space and what's happening on the upper floor of the cities.
Hello, I am Carlos Tanga. I am an illustrator and an architect, and I illustrate cities.
Carlo, I really wanted to speak to you because I've been hearing about people who make things in cities. Yeah. They're activists, they're building things. But do you take a view of the city? You absorb the city through your eyes and then through your drawings. So I guess let's take a step back, and I'm curious to hear, where did this passion came from? How did you end up being such a household name when it comes to illustration in cities?
I have always been drawing since I was a child. Like 2 years old, I was drawing everywhere, on every wall of my apartment, on the kitchen of my mother, everything. And so it's strange, because I was already at that age drawing buildings, basically building cities, very crowded places. I think it's something in my DNA. I don't know why. I remember that when I was 8 years old, I went to visit for the first time in my life Rome. And I visited the Pantheon in Rome, and I was so impressioned by this incredible dome, by this oculus opening to the sky. A sun ray entered suddenly inside this big temple after a rainy day, and I was really crazy about that. And when we were outside in the square, I said, I want to become an architect. And they always remember that to me, and probably it's something that I like. So there's not a particular reason. Then I realized that it's very beautiful to study cities, town planning, to understand the complexity of cities, because they are really a human phenomenon that represent very well human beings, humanity, because it's like, for example, the coral, this little octopus that is building corals in the sea, in the ocean, is something that we cannot do without. Cities allow us to express ourselves in the best way.
You have the job of depicting cities on paper through your drawings, through your sketches. Does that mean you have to pay more attention to cities? Or is it an exercise in patience and waiting for the city to reveal itself to you?
Oh, this is a very fantastic question, because I think that I need a lot of inspiration. So probably is the city that is talking to me first. And you must know that I consider cities just like people, persons. And every city has its own personality, its own character, is beautiful or less beautiful, very educated or less educated, is violent or peaceful. So every city is just like a person, and she or he or they speak to me. And I always feel this very big connection with the city, just like to be in front of a friend at a coffee table, speaking with her or him. I really think that this inspiration is coming from the city itself.
What is your method? Do you sketch on the spot? Do you take photos and use it as reference? Do you go back to the same place several times to understand that personality that you're describing? I'm curious to hear about your method.
Yeah, it's a mix of all these things, because sketching moment is very important, because when you sketch, you also are breathing the air of this place. You are observing very well all the people around, and you must know that to draw means to observe very well a place, because it means that you have to follow every line to catch every detail. And so at the end, you know very well this place just if you sketched it. And then on the second time, of course, I make a lot of pictures of this place, and I can deepen all these images on my desk and go on to improve this first sketch and finish it. Because my method is mixed between analog and digital. I scan all my sketches and drawings in outline, and then I color them mainly in Photoshop or in a digital program.
I'm curious to hear, for example, if you're in a new city, does sketching help you discover the city in a new way, or in a better way, I guess?
I try first to visit the city very well and to find out the place that is inspiring me the most. And then I begin to sketch it. And I think that it's very important to visit the city in every different place, like in the center, in the outskirts, everywhere, to know the personality of this friend, of this person, very well from very different points of view.
So in a way, because of doing all of that, the way you approach sketching means you end up knowing cities much better than if you're just visiting.
Absolutely. Sketching is incredible. It's like a scanner. It's like a way to deepen in an incredible way the knowledge of the city. You know, the eye are the organs of a human body that are moving more than heart and everything. And when you are sketching, they are moving like crazy. So they are taking every single point, every single details. And at the end, in your memories, all these details and images are very, very deeply fixed. And it's also a way to have a beautiful souvenir of the city, a big memory of the city.
On the last day of Utopian Hours, guests were graced with a once-in-a-lifetime experience to have breakfast at the iconic car testing track on top of Lingotto, the old Fiat factory. This was the chance to see a new project, which will open its doors to the public in a few weeks, and it has transformed the driving track into an amazing new public garden. The man tasked with this project is the architect Benedetto Camerana, a Turin native and one of Italy's leading practitioners in green architecture. The day before the breakfast, he gave me a private tour of the new space. And of course, there's only one way to get up there, by driving.
The electrical cars, the track is floating through the plants, through nature.
So we are here at Lingotto, finally, to see the amazing projects here on the roof. Maybe to understand a bit more about the significance, and this is such a historical building for Turin, but you know, for anyone who is a lover of industrial design as well, contextualize a bit of the building before we talk about where we are today.
So the Lingotto factory was built after the World War I, completed in 1923. This was a very important building for Fiat and probably one of the most important car production building in the world. And they pushed it to the limit of having a 5 floors building, 500 meters long, with 2 sides separated by courtyards, in which all the production was organized floor by floor. So the frames at the bottom, and then the engines were added, and then all the parts. And there are two ramps on the two top sides of the building. One ramp was to go up and one ramp was to go down. And on the top, the roof test track, it's to really test the cars. So the cars were tested on this half kilometer and half kilometer. So it's 1 kilometer run on the roof, which was also very confidential. No one could see. So it was a perfect system, and the cars simply were going to the market off the north ramp at the bottom when the process was completed. All this stopped in the 80s when the last Lancia Delta was produced here. And Gianni Agnelli, the nephew of the Senatore Agnelli, the founder of Fiat, decided to conserve the building and to transform it in a new part of town after a huge competition. At the end of the process, Renzo Piano was selected, and he made a great transformation of this building into a city itself. Every function of a city is inside this building. Every function, from museum to music hall, congress. The only part which was conserved exactly as it was, it's the place where we are. So the roof test track, which was left by the project of Renzo Piano as an icon of memory. Unfortunately, no program was developed, so it was in use for 30 years.
Then you came along and the project we are now seeing here today.
The chairman of the Pinacoteca, Ginevra Elkan, she had the idea of transforming this roof track, which was asphalt land, especially in the summer, very difficult and very heavy in temperature. They started to think, why don't we do something like the High Line of New York? A transformation open to the public, having nature coming as a garden.
So when you started thinking and went back to your studio and started thinking about what would this in reality look like, what were some of your main concerns?
The main concern was to have an idea of natural, spontaneous arrival of biodiversity, of nature conquering the roof. Like if the wind comes with sand and earth and seeds, naturally, spontaneous growing up, nature returning over the building, which is typical of industrial area abandoned. You can find plants growing spontaneously everywhere. That was the first idea. So the design of this 28 island that we made are very naturally designed. And moreover, we decided to have an enormous number of species, so real biodiversity garden. We have 300 species and hybrid kind of plants, and they are mostly indigenous. Every season, now we are at the end of summer, at the beginning of autumn, we have different colors. We want to have different colors. Consider that we are seeing now the plants just planted 3 months ago, and we didn't want the so-called immediate effect. Unfortunately, people cannot see through the radio, but you can see the plants grew high immediately. Like you see these herbaceous, all these perennials, they are fast in growing. They're fast and they have different colors. We have pinks, violets, whites, reds, blues everywhere. This is the idea of biodiversity.
Now, one of the things you mentioned is the best use of the area when approaching the project. Now, where we are walking, you've kept a track for cars. Next to us, we have a running track if people want to do the 1 kilometer round, and there's also a walking area. Why was it important for you to keep the track here? I know you mentioned that electric vehicles will be coming up, but was it part of it as well to try to keep that reference to memory, to the heritage of the space?
Absolutely, this is the point. This is a monument of industrial memory, and so the concept of having a, we call it pista, because the name of this is La Pista 500, pista is track. So keeping the pista, it was a main point of the project. So it's not just a roof area, whatever. It's a fantastic memory of the past. So the track, which now is only for electrical cars, so is dedicated to the future, as a contemporary redesign of this memory, of this icon of the past. This is the idea.
For Monocle in Turin, I'm Carlotta Ribello.
And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Many thanks to Carlotta Rebello for her report this week and to the team of Utopian Hours for hosting us. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rebello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Goldfrapp with Utopia. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.